So in this talk, I'm going to present our work on Glasnost, which is work done in collaboration with my colleagues Massimiliano Marcon, Saikat Guha, Krishna Gumadi, Ratul Mahachan, and Stefan Saroyu. Traditionally, forwarding packets in the internet was very simple, as routers only took IP source and destination address into account to decide how and where to forward internet traffic. But today, ISPs deploy traffic shapers widely. And while we don't take a stand here whether traffic shaping actually is acceptable or not, what we are really worried about is that ISPs often don't inform their customers about these traffic shaping deployments. Because this can be problematic as it leaves their customers in the dark about the potential impact of traffic shaping on their internet performance. And this is what we refer to as a lack of transparency. And as part of our Glasnost work, we're asking the question whether we can enable users to detect traffic shaping and thus make the networks more transparent. Because there's not much doubt about the various benefits of transparency. For example, end users benefit from transparency a lot as they can make a more informed choice about the ISP. And so they can avoid ISPs that traffic shape the applications they are most interested in. Also, developers can benefit from transparency as it allows them to adapt their application to ISP's policies. And this has happened in rare cases in the past already. For example, in the P4P project, a BitTorrent software vendor, an ISP, and researchers teamed up to create a new BitTorrent version which keeps traffic within an ISP's network. And this reduces the bandwidth cost for an ISP and potentially improves the performance for the users. Finally, transparency can even help regulators, because today there are really no independent sources for regulators for their task of monitoring ISPs. Instead, they solely rely on ISPs to give them information about what they do. And as you can see, this doesn't allow for an independent monitoring, for independently monitoring ISP and holding them accountable. Now, the goal of our Glasnost work is actually to make the network more transparent. And our Glasnost is actually a tool that allows end users to detect traffic shaping for their access links. In the rest of the talk, I'm going to show you how we actually do that. We deployed Glasnost publicly in March 2008. And since then, more than 500,000 of users used Glasnost to test their access links. And the map you can show here shows the location of our users. They came from more than 5,800 ISPs and more than 180 countries. And our Glasnost results were actually used by regulators for their investigations against ISPs. In the rest of the talk, I first want to present to you our Glasnost system design and show you how Glasnost works. After that, I want to talk about the experiences we had with our Glasnost deployment and which results we were able to obtain from this deployment. And in the end, I will conclude. In this talk, I want to take a retrospective view on how we designed Glasnost and how it actually got adopted by so many users. And in the following, I will first outline a number of challenges we identified while building Glasnost and what design choices we took while implementing Glasnost. Now, there are mainly three design challenges we identified, and I will talk about all of them in more detail on the following slides. The first challenge is tests must be easy to use. The second challenge is tests must be short. And the third challenge is tests must be accurate. Now, talking more about the first challenge, tests must be easy to use. That's, of course, a very obvious challenge here. But it turns out that getting this right in practice is very hard. For example, we cannot require users to perform complex software installations. Most end users will not be capable of doing that, and so they would be excluded from our test. That's something we want to avoid. Additionally, there have been other tests in the past that could detect traffic shaping, but they required users to set up rather complex experiments. And to our knowledge, none of these tools has been adopted widely. Second, the interface of the test must be simple and intuitive. And a good example for that pops to mind are actually the internet speed tests probably every one of you has used in the past already. And now let me show you how Glasnost looks from a user's perspective. As you can see in the screenshot, it's a web-based tool. And to run it, a user simply browses to our web page and selects a test he wants to run. For example, we have a test for BitTorrent, for GNUtella, but also for Flash Video. And you can test whether these applications are traffic shaped. To run the test, you simply click the Start Testing button. And so your browser will then load a Java applet. This Java applet will perform all the necessary measurements to detect traffic shaping. By using a Java applet in the browser, we don't require end users to perform additional software installations or interact with our test in any other way. But of course, while this is very simple and allows a large number of users to run our test, this has some restrictions in practice. Because there are certain things you just simply cannot do in a Java applet easily. For example, we cannot collect a packet trace on the client side or run traceroute. Once the test has finished, we are displaying a results page to the user and tell the user for his individual link of the time of the test run whether we found traffic shaping or not. Like in this example, we could tell the user that we found rate limiting of BitTorrent uploads. Now, the second challenge I want to talk about is that tests must be short. And that's something we learned during our deployment of Glasnost. Because initially, we had a 20-minute long test of Glasnost, which allowed us to collect all sorts of data. And the graph I'm showing you here actually shows the individual test runtime per user. And we were actually pretty much surprised when we got the following results. Only 30% of the users would let the test finish and would see the results page in the end. And more than 50% of the users would abort the test even before they would let run for 10 minutes. Now, we were really surprised by this result because we are telling the user how long the test will take before the user can start the test. And we even show a progress bar to indicate how long the test will take to finish. But this result has one clear consequence. 20 minutes is simply too long for most of the users. And instead, we need a much shorter test. So what we did in Glasnost was we deployed a second test, which only took 6 minutes. And as you can see in this graph, now more than 80% of users would let the test finish. Now, shorter tests, of course, come at a price because it, in effect, decreases the amount of data we can collect during our measurements. The third challenge is another very obvious one. Our tests must be accurate. But in fact, it's inherently important in our case to be correct. The reason is that we, on the one side, we are dealing with ISPs here. And if our test would raise false accusations, it could severely damage an ISP's reputation and business. And that's something we clearly want to avoid here. On the other side, as we even allow lay users to use our test, we have to be aware that they don't have the expertise to interpret our results in any ways. And instead, they will take our results at face value. To create accurate tests, we have to avoid the confounding factors in our test design. And the confounding factors I'm showing you here are not unique to Glasnost, but they apply to all internet measurements. The first confounding factor is heterogeneous hardware and software configurations. The example for that is that different networking stacks or different TCP congestion control will result in different measurement outcomes. And additionally, users can deploy hardware like personal firewalls or netboxes that could affect our measurements. And so we have to be aware of that while designing our test. Secondly, we have to be aware of differences in the natural traffic patterns of application. An example for that is that if you want to detect BitTorrent traffic shaping, and compare the throughput of BitTorrent to a simple HTTP download, the results you will get are not very meaningful because the networking characteristics HTTP and BitTorrent have are inherently different. Finally, all network measurements can be affected by transient noise, which are often caused by a background network traffic. And in effect, we should try to avoid noise as much as possible in our data set. And if we, even if we cannot do that, we should be able to account for it and tolerate it in some way, or at least filter it out. Avoiding these confounding factors is made even more hard because we can only collect so and so much data. I told you before that the total duration of our tests is restricted by the patience of the users. And additionally, we can only use test data from a single user access link. The reason for that is that not necessarily all users of an ISP might be affected by traffic shaping, but there can be partial deployments of traffic shaping. Now, let me tell you how we actually detect traffic shaping and how we construct Glasnost tests. In Glasnost, we perform active measurements in a controlled fashion. And this means we only perform measurements between a user and one of our Glasnost measurement servers. And in our analysis, we only consider these measurements between these two parties and no additional data. Now, how do we construct our tests? In Glasnost, we send a pair of flows. The first flow emulates realistic application traffic. And so the first flow will, for example, be a flow that just looks like BitTorrent, like it came from an arbitrary BitTorrent software. Right after the first flow, we send a second flow that varies the payload of the first flow, but keeps everything else the same. And we then check for differences in the performance of the two flows. And in our current implementation of Glasnost, we focus on throughput, but our methodology isn't limited necessarily to throughput alone. Now, let me go into more detail here, and on the example of detecting BitTorrent traffic shaping. And there are actually two types of traffic shaping we can detect in Glasnost. The first is port-based traffic shaping, and the second is content-based traffic shaping. And the figures I'm showing you here show a typical BitTorrent protocol exchange, like an arbitrary BitTorrent client would send it. Now, to detect port-based traffic shaping, what we do is we first send a flow on a well-known BitTorrent port, and then send a second flow on a neutral port. Now, if there's traffic shaping, these two flows will have different throughput, and we can use that to detect traffic shaping. Now, how do we detect content-based traffic shaping? In this case, we again send the first flow, but then we change the second flow by replacing the BitTorrent messages with random bytes. Now, the second flow for a traffic shaping equipment will look like just random bytes being sent, not like a BitTorrent flow anymore. But note that besides the payloads, we keep everything else the same. The size of the packets, the order of the packets, the timing of the packets, and the TCP port we are sending these flows on. And so on the networking level, both flows look exactly the same and should perform the same. But if there are differences in throughput, we found evidence for content-based traffic shaping. And nicely, by constructing our tests like that, we avoid our second confounding factor, as the traffic patterns of our test flows are the same. And I also showed you before how we avoid heterogeneous hardware and software configurations by only taking in the measurements from one user to one of our server, which keeps the configuration fixed. I haven't talked about transient noise yet. As you all know, transient noise often comes from background network traffic. And to avoid it in the first place, we ask the user to stop all background transfers that are currently going on while running our test. But of course, some users will ignore this advice. And sometimes users aren't even aware of background flows that are going on, like when Windows starts an update. And so we need to do more here to identify noise and to also filter it out if the flow is too noisy. And so here's how we identify noisy tests. We repeat the flow pairs several times over a few minutes. And this allows us to compare the throughputs of the repeated flows, for example, of all the BitTorrent flows. And so if there's no noise, they should, of course, perform the same. And so any difference in the same flow can be accounted to noise. Looking over our data set, we were able to identify four noise patterns, which I briefly want to introduce to you. And the graph I'm showing you here just shows examples for each of these patterns. There's a low noise pattern, where all of our throughput measurements will be very similar. And so the maximum, median, and minimum throughput measurement I'm showing in this graph will be very close together. There's a case we call occasional high noise, where most of our throughput measurements will be very close to the maximum throughput measurement. But there are occasionally outliers where the throughput we measure is much smaller. There's the variable high noise case, where all of our throughput measurements will be very insimilar, and the medium throughput we're measuring will be far away from the maximum and minimum throughput we measured. And finally, there's the consistent high noise case, where most of our measurements will be very close to the minimum throughput measurement we took, and there are occasionally measurements that have much higher throughput. Now it turns out that the first two noise patterns we can actually tolerate in our analysis. The reason for that is that in these cases, the maximum throughput we measured is very likely to be very close to the throughput you would get without any noise. While in the cases 3 and 4, this isn't the case, as we cannot be sure that the maximum throughput we measured there is anywhere close to the non-noisy case. So we have to filter out the variable high noise cases and the consistent high noise cases. But the good news is that most of our measurements actually have low noise, and that if we only consider the low noise case and the occasional high noise case, we are still left with more than 80% of our tests. And now that we only have these tests that have low noise or occasional high noise, we can use them to detect traffic shaping. And we do that by comparing the maximum throughput achieved by the two flows. But now, we have to be aware that we can err on two sides here. There can be false positives, where Glasnost detects traffic shaping when the ISP, in fact, is not traffic shaping. And the other side is there can be false negatives, where Glasnost detects no traffic shaping while the ISP is traffic shaping. Now, I told you before that we have to be... So in Glasnost, we decided to err on the side of caution. And I told you before that it's important to not falsely accuse ISPs, as it will affect their business. And so in Glasnost, we decided to keep the focus on the false positive side and to minimize the false positive with priority. But of course, we also want to keep the false negatives as small as possible to not irritate the users. What we do in Glasnost is we declare something as being traffic shape when the two flow pairs perform more different than a certain threshold. Now, the problem here is that getting this threshold right is actually tricky. If we choose a threshold that's too high, then we get more false negatives while having smaller false positives. And vice versa, if the threshold we choose is too low, we get fewer false negatives but more false positives. The nice thing is we found a sweet spot here, and you can find details about it in the paper. But let me tell you that we were able to push the false positive rate below 1% and the false negative rate below 2%. Now that I told you how Glasnost works, let me tell you more about our Glasnost deployment. And I want to show you results we conducted with Glasnost about BitTorrent rate limiting. Glasnost is currently deployed on 20 servers on 9 sites worldwide. And most of our servers are actually hosted by Measurement Lab, which is an open platform for internet measurement tools, which provides dedicated measurement service locations around the planet. We founded Measurement Lab in collaboration with Google, Planet Lab, and other academic researchers. Now, using our Glasnost data set, we were able to study BitTorrent rate limiting in detail. And we're answering a whole number of questions. Unfortunately, due to the lack of time, I will not be able to talk about all of them in detail. But I will focus on the first two ones: how prevalent is BitTorrent rate limiting, and which ISPs rate limit BitTorrent traffic. And I would like to refer you to for details about the other questions in the, to the paper. Now, how prevalent is BitTorrent rate limiting? We found that during our 18th month of deployment, roughly 10% of our BitTorrent tests indicated rate limiting. And you can also see that this percentage of tests that were affected by rate limiting stays roughly the same over this whole period. And given the large user base we have, this means that actually a significant number of users experience rate limiting. But which ISP's customers are affected? Now, in our analysis, we limit ourselves to January and February 2009. Reason for that is that ISPs might change their policy. By restricting ourselves to a short time period, we can avoid biases by, that might be imposed by that. But we have more than 100,000 measurements during this period, which gives us a nice data set here. We actually found that major ISPs worldwide, users of major ISPs worldwide, to be affected by BitTorrent rate limiting. And the table I'm showing you here gives some examples of the biggest one, like Bell Canada, British Telecom, and Clearwire in the US. As I told you, there are other results we got from our Glasnost data set. For example, we found that rate limiting is much more common in the upstream direction, and that ISPs seem to identify BitTorrent flows both by packet content and by ports. We also found that not all users of an ISP are necessarily affected by traffic shaping, but that some ISPs will only shape their users at peak hours. And that actually confirms announcement by British Telecom, Bell Canada, and Kabel Deutschland about their practices. And as I said, there are more details about these results in the paper. Now, I showed you how we can use Glasnost to study and to detect BitTorrent rate limiting. But of course, there are many more policies that ISPs might use. And even more, ISPs' policies can evolve over time as ISPs target new applications or different policies and shaping mechanisms. On the other side, we received a lot of emails from our users where users were interested in different tests, different policies, and so on. The problem was that our test construction process was a manual one and required a full understanding of the protocol implementation and application protocol itself. As you can imagine, constructing the tests in this way is a laborious and error-prone task, and clearly it doesn't scale to the number of policies that could be out there. So we had to simplify that. And let me show you how we did that. We automated our test construction with a tool called Trace Emulate. And with Trace Emulate, it's much simpler to construct new tests. You only capture a trace of application traffic and then feed that into our Trace Emulate tool. Trace Emulate will extract key features from the input trace that are then be used in the emulation of the application flow in Glasnost. The resulting test configuration can be uploaded to our Glasnost server, and you can run them like any pre-existing test. And again, you can find more details about how to construct tests in the paper. Now let me conclude. Glasnost enabled end users to detect traffic shaping, and it actually got widely adapted as more than 500,000 users used it over the past 2 years. There are currently 8 tests of Glasnost, including BitTorrent and Flash Video. But we also created an interface which allows users to create their own tests, and so Glasnost can stay relevant in the future as well. The data we collected through Glasnost allowed us to perform the first large-scale study on the prevalence of BitTorrent blocking and rate limiting. And our results were actually used by telecommunication regulators in their investigations. And that's it for my talk. Thanks a lot for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer your question.
Hi, Ming Zhang from Microsoft Research, Redmond. So you mentioned that the false positive and false negative rate is 1%, 2% in your talk. Can you tell how you obtain those numbers?
Right. So you're pointing at a very good thing here. Actually, getting the ground truth for our evaluation is pretty hard because, as I told you, ISPs are not very open about their policies. But a nice thing currently is there are a lot of investigations by regulators going on. And especially in Canada, we have very detailed information about what ISPs are doing. And we use this information to in our evaluation. And there's more in the paper about that.
Hey, Marcel. Thanks. Very interesting work. I was wondering, what if the ISPs get onto this game and try to detect your measurement servers? Have you thought about what you're going to do to defend against that?
Right. So let me be upfront here. We chose a centralized implementation here. And centralized implementations are always vulnerable to whitelisting. And of course, we could have a decentralized approach. But getting that right is challenging and has, of course, its own problems. But we nevertheless tried our best to make it harder for ISP to evade detection by deploying Glasnost on a large number of servers, by open sourcing our code so that users can use our can set up their own Glasnost server, and by allowing users to write their own tests. But the other thing is, ISPs don't like to talk about their practices, but it's not clear whether they really will take actions to evade detection. The reason for that is that usually, if this eventually comes out, it's really bad for the reputation of ISPs. And by talking to ISPs, they never put the sign on me that they're actually interested in going this step in the end.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.